Hello everyone and welcome back to Not Always Polite. I hope you guys have had a great week so far. Today I am coming to you with an unsolved murder from Strathroy, Ontario. Before I get into it, I would like to thank everyone for listening this year. I got my Spotify Wrapped for podcasters or whatever back, and I'm just amazed that people listen to me every time I upload. Like, that's so crazy. I genuinely would not do this if people weren't listening, because that would be stupid. But seriously, thank you. I did post it on my Instagram if you want to check it out. But seriously, thank you guys from the bottom of my heart for listening to me talk about murders. It's really cool. So, without further ado, I will get on into the episode. So, the case takes place, like I said, in Strathroy, Ontario in 1975. So Strathroy is about 35 kilometers west of London, so it's pretty close. At the time of the case, Strathroy had a population of only 7,500. So I would say that's a pretty small town, but Strathroy has kind of a checkered past. So for instance, during the week of July 27th, 1975, there were 70, quote, occurrences investigated by the local police. That included things like limbs of trees falling on vehicles, and it went all the way to like hit and run accidents, and then of course murder. Today we're going to be talking about the murder of Irene Frances Gibbons. So she was known by Frances, so that's what I'm going to call her for the rest of the episode. Frances Gibbons was born in Oxbow, Saskatchewan, to her parents Thomas and Angela Gibbons. After spending some time there, they moved to Mount Bridges, Ontario. And then Frances and her mom relocated to Strathroy in 1953. Unfortunately, Frances' mom died a couple years after they moved to Strathroy. Frances was never married, and by the time 1975 came around, she was 66 years old and retired, and spent a couple decades living on her own. Before she retired, she worked at Craftmaster, a factory in Strathroy that specialized in manufacturing art kits. This job was especially convenient for Frances because it was within walking distance of her house and she didn't drive. Everything started off as planned for her on Thursday, July 31st, 1975. After getting dressed in a brown polka dot dress and eating breakfast, Frances set off on a 20-minute walk downtown from her Southside home. Typically, once a week, her best friend, Ruby Toner, drove Frances into town so she could pick up groceries and run other errands, but Ruby was not available this week. Once she got to town, Frances shopped for groceries at the grocery store called Foodland. She made the usual arrangements to have her groceries delivered later that afternoon. Then she stopped in at Eaton's on Front Street. During her errands, Frances passed by her neighbor, Mina Hawkins, on the street at approximately 11 a.m. When she was done in town, Frances walked back home and arrived home around noon. Once she got settled in, she chatted with a friend on the phone, and this was the last time anyone heard from Frances. Her groceries were delivered on schedule at around 4 p.m., but no one answered the grocery delivery boy's knocks on the front door. When Sandra DeBoer, a younger girl filling in for the usual newspaper carrier, delivered the newspaper, she noticed the groceries in the box on the front step, and she heard Frances' dog Tommy barking inside the house. She later said Tommy, the dog, was a skittery, nervous little thing, but he was barking more than usual on that day compared to other days that she had gone by. The next day, Sandra stopped by to deliver the newspaper and to collect payment for the week. She noticed Tommy was barking even more and the groceries were untouched. On a Saturday morning, when Sandra arrived to drop off the newspaper again, she became very concerned. Tommy was still barking furiously, and the newspapers from Thursday and Friday had not been brought inside, and the groceries were still on the stoop. Margarine from inside one of the groceries bags had even melted all over the concrete by the door. So obviously something was wrong. Sandra went home and told her mother about what she saw, and her mother quickly called the police. The police forced open Frances's front door at 9:35 a.m. on Saturday, August 2nd. Once they were inside, they found Frances strangled to death and posed on her back on her bedroom floor. The authorities immediately called the manager at Foodland and asked him to come to the house to identify Frances. Afterwards, the manager said, quote, Christ, all the years she lived here, I didn't even know where she lived until I had to identify her body. Once the authorities determined her schedule, they estimated Frances was killed sometime after she talked to her friend on the phone, but before the delivery came at 4 p.m. It was unlikely she would have left the groceries out on the step in the summer heat if she was able to answer the door. An autopsy was performed on Frances at London's St. Joseph Hospital by Dr. Eleanor Davies. She confirmed Frances was strangled to death with nylon stockings. She'd been restrained with the nylons and, quote, a wad of rags, stockings, and other fabrics were jammed into her mouth and down her throat. The nylons used to tie her up matched the ones found in her mouth. Frances's cause of death was officially listed as, quote, asphyxia resulting from the blockage of air passage and strangulation. There was no visible sign of sexual assault, but Dr. Davies reported foul play was definitely involved. So, because this was 1975, DNA testing was not an option, but Frances's entire house was dusted for fingerprints, but nothing useful was found. Her murder remains unsolved to this day. So, let's discuss the theories about who could have killed Frances. So, one of the first things that people always assume is it's someone who knew her. In this case, she doesn't have a husband, or else he would be the most likely suspect, but the first thought was it someone that she knew? So Frances was very careful, perhaps even a scared person who always kept her doors locked. It is unlikely she would have willingly let a stranger into her home, but there was no sign of forced entry. This seems to suggest she opened the door for someone she knew. Also, the killer either had, quote, good luck, or they were aware of Frances' schedule. Was it someone who knew her friend Ruby would not be joining her that day? Or, like, how many people in town would have known that? So, Frances was said to have kept to herself and did not have a large inner circle. It was reported at the time, quote, those who knew her best didn't know her well, and those who didn't know her well hardly knew her at all. People in town referred to Frances as, quote, that quiet lady, and a bit of a recluse. If someone from her small inner circle did kill her, given the limited number of potential suspects, you would think that her murder probably would have been solved by now. Frances only had one living relative, a brother named Thomas Gibbons, who lived in Hamilton, Ontario. At the time of his sister's murder, Thomas was 62 years old. There was some surprise in the community when he went through with his wedding only a week after his sister died, but I don't know, maybe they had a lot of money in the wedding and they couldn't postpone it. I don't know. So people are theorizing that Thomas could have done it, but what motive would he have had to murder his sister? Since Thomas was Frances's only living relative, I wonder if he would have inherited her estate. Nothing was reported about this, but if he did, then I suppose it's possible that was his motive, but it doesn't say anywhere if he did or not. It is important to note that the police never publicly suggested that Thomas was a suspect. So, if it wasn't someone from her inner circle, it could have potentially been a stranger. There was no sign of struggle, and none of Frances's nearby neighbors reported hearing any commotion or screams. But the police believe she may have been compliant if a stranger somehow managed to talk his way into her house, and maybe he said that he was only there to rob her. Authorities also think it's possible that the killer gained access to Frances's home while she was in town and waited for her to return. But there's a couple problems with this theory. There was no sign of forced entry, and did the killer really just sit around and wait while she visited with her friend and talked on the phone? It would be nice to know how long this conversation lasted, but it doesn't say. If it was a stranger killing, the motive was likely not robbery. A little money seemed to be missing from Frances's wallet, but other valuables were left in the home. Why did the murderer leave them behind if he was there for a robbery? Another thing that I found interesting is that Frances told her best friend Ruby that she had been receiving, quote, funny phone calls practically every night for 2 to 3 weeks leading up to the murder. She said the calls were placed by a man she didn't know, but Frances refused to disclose the content of the calls. She didn't say if they were threatening or, like, embarrassing. She didn't say. Frances did live across the street from a public school. She was killed in August, which means school was not in session at the time. This means the killer would have had ample opportunity to stalk Francis from the empty school grounds. Now, as some of you may know, London was the serial killer capital of the world for about 30 years between the 1950s and the 1980s. So serial killer was obviously a thought in the suspects of who killed her. So, on November 8th, 1975, an article in the London Free Press reported rewards totaling $38,500, which is almost $200,000 in today's money, were being offered to help solve the murders of seven Ontario women who had been killed over the previous 1.5 years. In addition to Francis's murder, two of the murders occurred in the Strathroy area. I did talk more about these in depth in a previous episode, but I'm going to just give a brief little rundown here anyways. On March 3rd, 1974, Judy Barksky, 19 years of age, was stabbed to death and her throat was slashed with a sharp object. Her body was discovered in a pool of blood near the Canadian National Railway station behind Bailey Farm Supplies in Strathroy. Authorities believe Judy left her boarding house on Maitland Terrace and walked along Frank Street to Pizza Delight. Once there, she picked up food and then took a shortcut across the CNR property. Approximately 40 feet from her body, police found soft drinks, candy bars, and pizza. They believe Judy dropped these items as she attempted to fight off and escape her attacker. Louise Jenner, who was also 19, had her throat slashed on October 20th, 1975. The crime occurred in her home on Highway 81 in Mount Bridges, which is around 11.5 kilometers from Strathroy. Her 6-month-old daughter was asleep in her crib during the crime and was unharmed. Louise's body was found by her husband only a few hours after she was killed. There was a car seen near their home around the time of the murder. It was described as, quote, a late model Oldsmobile Cutlass? Oldsmobile Cutlass with opera windows, medium brown with a cream-colored vinyl roof. But witnesses could not provide a description of the driver. Police checked over 1,800 cars registered from Windsor to Barrie that fit the description, but nothing came of that lead. So, that being said, it's a theory that Judy, Francis, and Louise's murders were potentially connected. There was a tentative connection between Louise and Judy. They both worked at the same pizza place. The connection, though, was not that telling since their employment at the restaurant did not overlap. They also didn't even work for the same owners. Also, no link was ever made between the young victims and Francis, who was 66 years old. Not only were their ages different, but they were also killed with a knife, whereas Francis was strangled. There were no murder weapons found at either crime scene, whereas stockings that killed Francis were left in her home. So, with that being said, I think Judy and Louise's murders could be connected, but not Francis's, but the authorities think otherwise. The OPP have had no leads in the murder of Judy, Francis, or Louise, but given the previously low murder rate in the region, the last murder before Judy occurred in 1925. Even without much evidence linking the crimes, they found it difficult to believe that they were not related. OPP Staff Superintendent JSK of the Criminal Investigations Branch said that, quote, they hadn't ruled out a link between the three Strathroy murders. He added there might even be a connection between the three murders and several others committed in nearby communities in the previous year. There was Pearl Inez Donald, who was 83, and she was stabbed to death in her home. Okay, this next one I have never heard of before, and it supposedly happened in my hometown. I think the article that I read spelled it wrong, but I'm gonna have to do more investigation on this because I was shook when I read it. Aletha Jane Henning, 57, was beaten and stabbed to death on September 20th, 1975, in her home in Ayton, which is about 16 kilometers northwest of Mount Forest. Violet Semple, 81, was beaten to death in her home, and then it was set on fire in November of 1975 in Markdale, which is about 80 kilometers north of Kitchener. So, despite the belief that some, if not all, cases were linked, this information has never helped to solve any of these murders. For the three Strathroy murders alone, which includes Francis's case, at least 10,000 interviews were conducted and tons of paperwork. The staff superintendent, Kay, had to admit that to the media that, quote, few solid leads has materialized. Regardless, he stressed, quote, we are still looking for a common denominator. It's very plausible that a serial killer was hunting in southern Ontario in the mid-70s. Several crimes discussed here may indeed be related, but it is still unclear if the person who stabbed and slashed the two young women to death in Strathroy is the same killer who strangled 66-year-old Frances. It's possible, but more evidence is needed to back that theory up. We're going to talk about one more murder, the murder of Jane Burton McCurdy. Did the murderer of Jane also kill Frances? In October of 1973, there was a murder in Hensel, Ontario, which is about 60 kilometers north of London. That seemed kind of similar. I meant to say familiar and similar. Similar to Frances's murder. Like Frances, 93-year-old Jane lived alone. She resided in a large frame house on the main street in Hensel with her two cats. She was last seen by neighbors on Thursday, October 4th, 1973, when she was raking leaves on her front yard. The next day, when Mrs. Fred Vivian arrived, Jane's friend who delivered meals and helped with housework, she became suspicious when there was no answer when she knocked on the door. She found the back door unlocked, which was unusual. She went home and called Jane, but couldn't get through. It was later discovered the phone line to Jane's house had been cut. Jane's friend called police. When they entered the home to do a welfare check, they found Jane's naked body on the bedroom floor. The murder of Jane was, without a doubt, a sex crime. The Center of Forensic Science in Toronto determined she had been sexually assaulted, whereas this blatant evidence was missing in Frances' case. It's extremely likely Frances' murder was a sex crime, despite the lack of evidence. So there are a couple interesting differences in the cases. First, the authorities found signs of attempted entry in at least two locations at Jane's house. This was not found at Frances's. Secondly, Jane's phone lines were cut, but this didn't occur at Frances' house. However, it was later reported repairmen had been working on Jane's phone lines earlier in the week, leaving it quite possible that whatever was wrong with her phone lines was something related to this work and not connected to the murder. An autopsy was done on Jane, and like Frances, she was strangled with nylons. The nylons were not tied with a typical knot, rather the elaborate and tightly fastened restraints were made by someone who had done this before. It appeared as though the perpetrator had tied up Jane with one of the pairs of nylons, then grabbed another pair and tightened it slowly around her throat while they assaulted her. Jane's killing suggested the work of a sadistic sexual homicide. This is not the type of killing done by a panicked burglar who had been caught in the act. But it seemed likely that this kind of killer would kill again. Did this person murder Frances around a year and 9 months after murdering Jane? I think that it's highly likely given the similarities in this case. 47 days after Jane's murder, George Lloyd Salter of Kippen, Ontario was charged with her murder. Little is known about this trial, but in April of 1974, a jury found the 39-year-old sheet metal worker not guilty after deliberating for only 3.5 hours after a 9-day trial. Same with Frances's case, Jane's murder also remains unsolved. So I would like to know what you guys think on Instagram. Please let me know about what you think about all these theories. Just a little tie up here to end things off. Frances was mourned by her few loved ones and friends and laid to rest in Strathroy's Roman Catholic Cemetery. Justice for Frances has yet to be attained. The community of Strathroy still waits for answers. Shortly after Frances' horrific murder, Police Chief William Smith said, quote, "If a woman in this town isn't afraid, then there's something the matter with her. The residents of Strathroy were terrified. Before the crime spree in the region, few people locked their doors. After the killings, locks sold out at the local hardware store." The grocery store manager explained, "It's a small town and people are shook." I can't believe that he said shook. I thought that was funny. If you have any information about Frances's murder, please contact the Strathroy Cardock Police at 519-245-1250. Or if you can assist the authorities with any of the murders mentioned in this case, call the Royal Canadian Mounted Police at 613-993-7267. So I talked about a lot in this episode, but I will put pictures and all that good stuff on Instagram. Don't forget to follow me there for updates, and please leave me a review wherever you're listening. I will catch you guys next week. Have a good week, guys. Bye.